J Files on Double J.
For most of us, the music we loved in the 90s was all about guitars. But there was one band who emerged from the suburbs of Sydney with a distinctly different sound. The Whitlams used piano-driven pop ballads and tongue-in-cheek lyrics to tackle the full gamut of human emotion and experience. And it just worked. They're recognised as one of the iconic Australian bands of the last two decades, and for very good reason. Hey, Gab Burke here, J-Files producer at Double J, and this is the J-Files podcast. Every week, we dive into the amazing stories behind your favourite music. Today, we follow the incredible story of the Whitlams, a journey of extreme highs.
Suddenly the album just started piling out the stores and we were broke. But it was one of those moments where a song does all the work.
And awful, awful lows.
From the wreck, from the ashes, I'd managed to put an album together that captured people's imagination, and so it was a bit of a fairy tale, but it was like any good fairy tale, there was this huge sadness behind it.
And if any of the content in this podcast brings up issues for you, you can call Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. Today, you're going to hear from the Whitlams frontman, Tim Friedman. He sat down for a chat with Mike Williams, who actually used to produce the J-Files, but now presents the incredible ABC podcast, The Real Thing. And just as a side note, you should definitely check that out. But Mike is a massive Whitlams fan, so he was keen to talk to Tim and get the full story behind the band. And I'd love to jump straight into how the Whitlams started, but actually, there's quite a bit that happened beforehand. Half an hour
away from the creeping smoke. I was in a ska band called Itchy Feet. You know, we were on a TV talent show and we played all the universities. That was a lot of fun. We got a bit of a following. In a big way, hey, hey, in a big way. I'm in love with you, but you're in trouble with me. And I was in a band called Penguins on Safari and then set up three or four other little acts and basically just got used to booking gigs, going to pubs saying, we're going to put a band on, you know, even creating our own rooms. Just trying to corral drummers, just trying to keep a band together. When there's no money, you've got to do it with hope. You've got to convince people that there's a dream, that they're going somewhere, which is all just snake oil. And, you know, you end up having a huge turnover in the bands. Well, then I became a sideman for a while, and I did 7 weeks playing the piano and Sunny Boys, and then I played the piano in the Hummingbirds just after they released Love Buzz.
That would have been some big shows.
Yeah, they did. They were going really well. Yeah, absolutely. Simon and Lana. So I toured with them and I sort of realised, I enjoyed the whole process. I enjoyed the touring and the crowds and everything, but I wanted to be a band leader. So I sort of stopped doing that stuff and formed another band called The Olive Branch with my brother. And on the side, I met these two guys at the pub, Andy Lewis and Stevie Plunder, who were originally from Canberra. And they were really good musicians, folk musicians, double bass and guitar. And we just started jamming and playing each other's songs. And even though I wasn't putting as much time and effort into that little band, it just had a bit of chemistry. And when we started playing on Saturday afternoons at the local pub, people just started coming along. And so it got its own momentum. The Whitlams was really easy because we just would turn up. We didn't have to rehearse that much because they were such great musicians with great ears and the harmonies would just come out. We wouldn't need to work on it. I get high,
trouble arises, something in me surrenders and falls. I get high, trouble arises, something in me surrenders and falls.
So Tim met Andy and Stevie, and the Whitlams were born. Where to from here?
We worked really hard. I had never really got out of Sydney with music, and I was ambitious. So as soon as I was in an act that seemed to draw crowds and people enjoyed, I would be on the phone booking shows in Coffs Harbour and Byron Bay and Brisbane, and we'd go up and Newcastle. We'd go up and down the coast every 7 weeks. So I had a Kingswood, and everything would fit in this Kingswood station wagon. You know, the piano would be in the back, double bass next to it. One person would lie on the piano, and two guys in the front bucket seats, and that, you know, drive to Brisbane and back every 7 or 8 weeks. And we'd go down to Melbourne overnight and play the SB on Thursday night after an 11-hour drive. It was always a tough gig. We'd get a hotel room at the Cosmopolitan in St Kilda, and there'd be four mattresses on the floor. You know, it was, you know, scrappy. But
sounds like fun, though.
Well, yeah, it was, because we were young and full of the devil, you know. We just really learned how to play, how to talk to an audience. Stevie was a natural humorist. Andy was shy on stage, but off stage he was a very funny guy. We had a lot of laughs. We were all, you know, we were all drinkers. So that, of course, has its ups and downside. But during the show and after the show, it was always a lot of laughs. So we, you know, we do 150, 160 shows a year. Then we got a little deal with Phantom Records, Sebastian Chase, and got some money to record an album, and did that pretty quickly. You know, there were just four studio tracks and the rest of it was just live stuff. And then that started getting played on Triple J in 1993, especially the song Goff. Then, of course, we could start playing. 200 people would start coming along to the Annandale Hotel, or the Sandringham and the Hopetoun and the Annandale. And, yeah, it developed like that. And then started thinking about the second album.
Thursday I get depressed.
I think this is on the live album.
Yeah, I remember now. Friday, my head's a mess.
Dave, stop it.
On some of those early live recordings, you can hear Stevie interacting with the crowd too. Seemed like a bit of a double front man act there. Is that? Can you tell me about that dynamic?
Stevie wrote great songs, narrative songs, a lot of detail and effort and stories and some pretty dark subjects, but very finely wrought. We never had this competitive thing with songwriting. We just knew that it was good if he sung about half the songs and I sung about half and Andy sang one. On stage, in terms of banter, he was a funny guy and we'd try and play off each other, you know, a bit of Morecambe and Wise. And it's always nice if it's two people on stage. It just seems to be more of, it can go anywhere when you're chatting or discussing the day, or then we'd start hassling each other, or find if there was lots of chat, you didn't have to play as many songs. And and when you're playing 3 45-minute sets, that can help.
Yeah.
Lester Walker was an angry talker. He went to parties but always stood alone. People amused him, he was always looking on. But now Lester Walker's gone.
One of the great things about the Whitlams was that they kept it local. They used Sydney suburbs as reference points and they created characters from real people that they'd met. Something Mike was keen to talk to Tim Friedman about.
One of the reasons I love the Whitlams so much is because of those references. And I'm not even from the inner west of Sydney, but I knew of these places, and it was, even not being from there, just looking towards there and feeling like you were representing me in some way as an Australian. And now, coincidentally, I live near Tempe, and every time I drive through, I think, you know, never rains in Tempe, and I'm always looking for when it's raining in Tempe.
Never rains in Tempe. The planes remind me of family money, and the lad down here starts talking.
Which I'm glad I remember the Tempe line, not the Marrickville line.
By the time she gets to Marrickville, we'll be masturbated.
They were just silly pop references, because my dad always used to play this song.
Seems it never rains in
I just said, oh, it never rains in Tempe, you know. And by the time she gets to Marrickville, we'll be, you know, Jimmy Webb. By the time she gets to Phoenix, I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
She'll be rising.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, well, I'm not Jimmy Webb. You know, it's just, we're just got hangovers, and by the time she gets to Marrickville, we'll be having a wank. makes you feel as if you're not in some backwater and, you know, you can have your own songs.
I shouldn't have driven, you shouldn't have driven, but we got there, had a good time, left the car, and the cabbie was from a war zone.
While they wrote songs about their beloved city of Sydney, there was one song that really captured the whole country, and we're going to get to that very soon. But if you've ever seen the Whitlams live, you'll know they put on a show.
Thank you.
And there's nothing better than Tim Freedman at full flights on that piano. But he doesn't seem to think so.
One of the main ambitions in my life is to be able to play the piano really well. And I haven't really got there yet. No, I'm still looking for a teacher. I'm not kidding. I do my own thing. I have a bash. I sing my words over the top of it. It's nothing too complex. I usually get good guys in to do the fiddly bits.
Really?
Yeah, I got... Well, the first few albums, Chris Abrahams would do the piano solos. And then Aaron Ottignon did a few, and Matt McMahon. I do all the foundation piano, and I write the songs on the piano. But I get jazz heads in for the fiddly bits. And it's a lifelong drama, or just... procedure, learning to play the piano, and I'm hoping to spend more time on it.
So someone else would write and record a piano solo, and then you would have to learn it. Is that right?
Oh no, you don't. No, I don't learn the solo. It just exists on the record.
But when you do it live, I've seen you do it live.
Yeah, but I don't do big piano solos. Or if I do, they're just solos that just aren't quite as good as on the record. That's all. You know, we don't copy the record live. Increasingly, we just get on stage, just four of us, and just do a nice, energetic version of what's on the album. I don't think we need to repeat the... hear it replicated.
So you're looking... Tim Freeman's looking for a piano teacher. What do you want to play that you're not currently playing?
Oh, just a bit more jazz. I love listening to jazz, and I think I'll start playing it a little bit more, even if it's just for myself.
I'll always keep the light on for you. You try so hard to be alive. What else can you do? But close your eyes, you can't see the beautiful way when you're burning so bright.
The Whitlams song that captured the hearts of the nation. In 1997, it came in at number one in Triple J's Hottest 100 music poll. No Aphrodisiac was the hit single of the band's third studio album, Eternal Nightcap.
We put the album out in September 97. Didn't even have the money for a film clip. I got 50 cassettes and I dubbed No Aphrodisiac on it. And on the front of it in text, I wrote a letter to you. And I put it in every pigeonhole in this building. Downstairs.
The ABC building.
Yeah. Triple J. Triple J it was. And probably, you know, 2BL and 2FC, as they used to call Radio National. So that was a very effective $40 marketing campaign.
And that's part of the opening line, a letter to you on a cassette.
Exactly. That's the first line of the album. So yeah. I guess no one knew who it was. I didn't say who it was from.
Oh, you didn't write the Whitlams on it?
No, I just put a letter to you on a cassette and put a cassette in the pigeonholes.
Nice one.
Yeah, and so I don't know if anyone played it, but if they did, it would have been a letter to you on a cassette. Oh, is this for me?
Because we don't write anymore.
You know, a few weeks later, put the album goes to everyone. They started playing No Aphrodisiac, and it just went mad. A lot of people thought it was an English band. It didn't really have anything to do with Sydney or anything. It was a song that worked just because it was pretty. It was about loneliness, but then it got funny. You know, it had a real... development, and it just got a life of its own. And then suddenly the album just started piling out the stores. We had no marketing budget. It was on our own label. We were broke, but it was one of those moments where a song does all the work. And I'm forever thankful that Triple J were flexible enough to put a ballad in the middle of a playlist which was pretty dominated by guitars and grunge at that stage. And so as soon as they were brave enough to do that, it stood out like a sore thumb, because there was this slow 4 minutes in the middle of everything else, which was probably a bit more brash and abrasive. And then it got voted in, I suppose people were voting for it in December. And then suddenly it was number one on Australia Day.
And where were you when you found out?
We went and did the interview in Adelaide. We were playing with Hunters and Collectors that night. And of course we were very excited. I went down to the co-writer's house in Camperdown, which was Glenn and Chit Chat, as he's called now, and Pinky Beecroft from Machine Gun Fellatio. I'd borrowed, you know, five or six lines of their song to put in at the end, and we had a drink and celebrated.
Which lines were they?
40 Shave Sexy, You Want to Do It All Day, and the gun toting trigger happy tranny named Kinky Renee.
Right.
They'd written that at a house I rented, and I always thought it was hilarious. And I thought, well, if I'm going to make this guy just start losing his mind completely, then I'll use Machine Gun's lyrics at the end. So it's three writers are credited with No Aphrodisiac. When No Aphrodisiac hit, I was 33 and broke. I'd been at it for 10 years, and so I really didn't take anything for granted. I knew we had to put on good shows, we had to be professional, I knew we had to keep writing, I knew the next album had to be good. I wasn't going to let this opportunity go. When fondness makes the heart grow absent, I gotta find it up a little closer to the ground. Yeah, when fondness in my heart is absent, I'm in awe of the sabotage within.
While the band was achieving success musically, a very deep sorrow surrounded the Whitlams. Tim Friedman is the only surviving member of the original trio. Stevie Plunder died in 1996 and Andy Lewis died in 2000.
We'd put out two albums. Andy had actually left the band in around 95. And so Stevie and I had put out undeniably the Whitlams, which had I Make Hamburgers on it, and his song Follow My Tracks. And then he died in January 96, you know, for obviously very complicated reasons. I think what... And then you've got to remember Andy didn't die until 2000, after another two albums.
Yeah, right.
And he hadn't been in the band for 3 years or so. I did write a song about that, but to go in order, Eternal Nightcap certainly had songs that were about friendship, and one specifically, Charlie Number Three, about someone ending their life and what they're feeling at the time. But I think it was more the impression that it was all about Stevie was more a sort of almost a media
right
impression, because you look at a band's CV, you realise that there's been a tragedy, an album's come out. Charlie 1, 2 and 3, everyone would assume was about Stevie, but they were songs I'd been writing for 10 years. Charlie 1 was about another fellow, Charlie 2 was about another fellow, and Charlie 3 was about a different friend. And I suppose as a songwriter, I decided to shape them into a narrative, and it worked because people saw it as a story, even though I'd had three sources for the story. And what was amazing about the story was Stevie died in January 96. I had maybe 9 or 10 people through the band, drummers, bass players. It was a really tough time, deciding even whether to keep going. Andy was nice enough to come back for 3 or 4 months and play with me and help me through that period. And he actually recorded a lot of the bass on Eternal Nightcap. But then he left the band again. But then 18 months later, we put out an album. And 2 years later, from when Stevie died, we had a number one in the Hot 100. And it was suddenly, oh my God, you know, just from the wreck, from the ashes, I'd managed to put an album together that captured people's imagination. And so it was a bit of a fairy tale, but it was like any good fairy tale, there was this huge sadness behind it, which gave it depth. And I was sort of away. As for Andy, he wasn't in the band. He died again for very complicated reasons. And I wrote one particular song about that called The Curse Stops Here.
Stevie left on a Friday too. They made the easy way look hard.
I'd been touring in Canada when it happened, and when I heard, I was devastated to think that all these rousing, rollicking times where we were in the back of a Kingswood doing 150, and I was the only one left from that car, and that would remember all the good times and be able to reminisce, etc. And the sadness for Andy that he was going through such torment and grief and leaving a, you know, kid and a wife. And so I wrote a song called The Curse Stops Here, just trying to come to terms with the grief of it.
'Cause I am the lost one. And the curse stops here. The curse stops here.
It's also about how, I suppose, one of the things of the songs and Eternal Nightcap and Love This City is that they're about how much we mean to each other. That's all. That's probably the type of songs that I've written that have touched people the most are the ones where I just celebrate friendship and how much we care. And it's not necessarily about a boy and a girl, but it can be boys and men and men, male friendships in a lot of them.
Seems Stevie helped me through from over there. But will his friends now help?
And if this brings up any issues for you, the number again for Beyond Blue is 1300 22 46 36 and Lifeline is 13 11 14. Tim Friedman decided to push on with the Whitlams and he explained to Mike why.
I was a bit of a lifer, which means I'd put all my eggs in the music basket. So I was always going to keep going in some form. After Stevie died, I was down the coast just sitting at a pool and I'd hear I Make Hamburgers on the radio. I think they used to play Triple J over the speakers at Thurool Pool through the tinny little speakers. So I decided to put the band, put another lineup together and just keep writing.
What a journey it's been, and continues to be. The last Whitlam's album to date was released in 2006. So will there be any new material?
Well, I've got to find a theme. I always wrote when I had a theme. I don't just sit down and something comes out. It's not an expressionistic tone poem. I want to write a theme, and just my mind's been elsewhere lately, that's all.
Okay. Well, good luck finding the theme.
Any suggestions?
I'll email you. Little song about a man called Goth and a little boy wanted to be tall with the same brush. He learned Latin, held his head up high, and he hated the liberals, though he didn't know why.
That's it from me. What's in the J Files next week? I'm Gab Burke. Catch you later.
The J Files.